I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Here in the United States, we have rehabilitation centers for criminals. The idea behind the centers is that some criminals, at least, can be reformed and sent back into society. Well, Saudi Arabia is trying something similar with Muslim extremists. A few months ago, we reported on a special rehabilitation center run by the Saudi government in Riyadh. Reporter Kate Seeley was there, but her access was limited at the center. So today we're going back. This time we're going deeper inside the center with Shiraz Maher, who's a freelance journalist. He filed a report for the BBC. He joins us now from Birmingham, England. Shiraz, describe first this center that's run by the Saudi government.
It's really quite remarkable. This is nothing like how you would imagine a typical Saudi prison. They don't call it a prison. They call it the Care Rehabilitation Center. The prisoners are called beneficiaries, and there are six residential compounds there where these guys are housed. Each one is called a resort, and inside each center you have PlayStations, table tennis centers, swimming pools. It's like a holiday camp. I was moved to call it the Betty Ford Clinic for jihadists.
So how much access did you have when you were there?
We were given pretty unlimited access, actually. We were given access to the whole centre. We were able to move around through it and able to speak to a number of the guys being held there. That was quite remarkable for us.
All right. Well, let's listen to your story right now, and we'll hear from some of the people who are at the centre, who you spoke with, who are in the process, in theory anyway, of being rehabilitated. Let's hear your story.
On the outskirts of Riyadh, in a small walled compound, two men play table tennis. But this is not a social centre. It's a prison. Or as the staff call it, a care centre. And here, the Saudi government is exploring new ways to reform its wayward radicals, many of whom have been to Iraq and joined the insurgency. In August 2003, a tanker exploded outside the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad. Al-Qaeda intended the bomb to announce their arrival in Iraq. A 19-year-old Saudi man called Ahmed al-Shaya delivered that message for them.
The tanker was in a building. I got into it with two Iraqis and they checked I could drive. Then they got out and drove off. I was left alone. I drove the tanker straight ahead for 500 meters, where they told me to park it, next to some concrete blocks. As soon as I stopped, the tanker exploded.
Ahmed al-Shaya is the rarest kind of jihadist, a suicide bomber who survived.
The victims of the bombing were all civilians. There were 9 people killed. The media say 60 people were injured, but I say 61 because I was also a victim.
Are you honestly saying that you had no idea that this tanker was going to blow up?
Of course not. How could I get into a tanker that I knew was going to blow up?
Shaya is one of the care centre's star graduates. There's even a section of the visitor centre devoted to him. 192 men have passed through here in the last 18 months, 108 of them from Guantanamo Bay.
أَشْهَدُ أَنْ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ أَشْهَدُ أَنَّ مُحَمَّدًا رَسُولُ اللَّهُ.
Religious motivation inspired the men here to join the jihad. The care center is about two different things, reintegration and de-radicalization. The Saudis have a team dedicated to de-radicalization. They call it the Ideological Security Unit. It's headed by Dr. Abdurrahman Al-Hadlak, and his message is simple. Only the Saudi government has the right to authorize jihad, and there is no legitimate jihad today.
What we are trying to do is to show that what has been changed in Islam is what is Al-Qaeda doing. I mean, what is destroying the image of Islam is Al-Qaeda activities. I mean, we have been Muslim for a long time. We have been in a good relation with many other countries, with non-Muslims and everything. So this new phenomena, or this new extremist ideology, it's not a Saudi ideology.
But Saudi has been affected by that extremist ideology. Saudi Arabia's counter-terrorism forces training for operations at home and abroad. Between 2003 and 2004, more than 100 civilians were killed by terrorists. Saudi Arabia has arrested more than 700 militants this year alone, most of them suspected of planning attacks on the country's oil industry. And it's this domestic threat, as well as Iraq, that's the driving force behind the rehab program.
They gave me my job back within a week and even got me a promotion. They bought me this car and are giving me extra money every month.
They are the Ministry of Interior, and this is Mohammed Fozan, one of the graduates from the rehab center. His new life is being sponsored by the Saudi government.
They gave me an allowance to furnish my home, and they completely took care of all my wedding expenses. I got everything I wanted.
Financially supporting terrorists in this way might seem distasteful, but the Saudis insist it's an integral part of the rehabilitation process.
Isn't the government rewarding people for terrorist activity?
No, not at all. We are not rewarding people. We are supporting these people to have a normal life. Basically, that's the idea. We are trying to contain these people. Because when you support him, you are also supporting his family. You are also trying to win the heart and mind of his family and himself.
The care center staff are convinced that their recipe of religious reprogramming is working. In the 18 months since the center opened, none of the graduates have reoffended. But they realize it's early days. The men we met were Al-Qaeda's foot soldiers, not its leaders. Convincing them to give up their weapons might take a lot more than the center's softly, softly approach.
That report on a Saudi reform school was by Shiraz Maher. He's with us at the BBC studios in Birmingham now. Shiraz, that bomber who you interviewed, who drove the tanker that exploded at the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad in 2003, how did he survive the explosion?
It remains a mystery, to be honest. I found his story quite implausible, and a number of my colleagues who were there also struggled to accept his version of events. The story seemed a bit too convenient to be true.
And the other people that you talked to there, did you find their stories credible?
The other people we met, their stories were more credible. These were people who had largely gone to Iraq to fight in a more conventional sense, in that they didn't want to be suicide bombers. They wanted to fight with machine guns or to join the insurgency against British and American forces there.
You have a very interesting perspective on this yourself, Shiraz. We should say that you were once part of an extremist group yourself, correct?
That's correct.
What was the name of the group?
The group is called Hizb ut-Tahrir, which is Arabic. It means the Party of Liberation.
And where is it based?
It's actually a transnational organization. It was founded in Palestine in 1953. It doesn't believe in armed violence, but what it does do is create the moral arguments and moral imperatives in which terrorism operates.
So how long were you a member of the group?
I was a member for 3 years.
And your attraction to it was what? Where are you from? Are you from Birmingham?
Yeah, I'm originally from Birmingham. I was at university at the time. It was just after September the 11th, and I found Hizb ut-Tahrir's ideas to be very seductive and powerful at a time when I think there was a lot of confusion amongst people. And
what was the seductive part?
Well, this was a bold message. It was a message which rejected Western ideas such as capitalism and liberal democracy, but at the same time, it wasn't an Eastern ideology. It wasn't sort of preaching the kind of chaotic politicism we see in Pakistan or in the Middle East. It was preaching something which seemed much purer, this kind of ideological Islamism. In that sense, I don't think it's any different to the way people a lot older than me will have joined sort of Marxist or communist movements.
Well, your views on the extremist group that you were part of changed. It sounds like they changed on their own. Maybe you matured, you grew out of them somehow, correct?
Absolutely. I think, you know, everyone who has bought into a radical ideology at some point obviously was open to that interpretation, and there needs to be a similar willingness and openness on their part to re-examine the path that they've chosen.
And what prompted that re-examination for you?
For me, it was actually unusual in that I finished my undergraduate and I started a postgraduate PhD in Islamic political thought. At the time, I believed it was going to entirely reinforce the views that I held at that time. It was only when I began to then embark on my PhD research independently that I began to see an entirely different aspect of Islam that I'd never really heard of or experienced before.
Okay, so you figured that out on your own. How about the folks who are at these reform schools, again, where they're trying to be basically talked out of extremist activity? Is this something that can be taught, or is it self-discovery?
I think it can be taught, but it depends on what the teachers are saying. What I found at the Saudi prison was that they're not rejecting the idea of jihad in the modern age. What they're saying, for example, is that jihad is perfectly acceptable, and they would back, for example, young Saudis who fought in Afghanistan during the 1980s. What they're saying today, however, is that the state has not given permission for people to fight. So because the Saudi government didn't say you could fight jihad in Iraq, therefore they would say that's illegitimate.
Is that a persuasive argument, though, for these people?
For a lot of these people, it is, because the relationship that individual Saudi citizens have with their government is not like the relationship you or I would have with our governments in the West. They regard the government as being like their father in a way. And so if your father tells you and you're a young child not to do something, you don't do it.
But this is a very different realization than your own that brought you out of extremism.
Absolutely. And the problem here is that that relationship is what's holding these people back. And for us in the West, that's something we really need to consider, that if there is a fall, for example, in Saudi foreign fighters going into Iraq, that's only because the state has told them not to do it. That's an awful lot of trust for us in the West to put in the Saudi regime.
Shiraz Meher is a freelance journalist. If you'd like to hear a longer version of his report on this Saudi Arabia reform school for jihadists, go to theworld.org. Thank you, Shiraz.
Thank you.